interview is taking place at the state capitol on December 1st, 1994.
This is all I'm going to operate on.
And Senator Fallon, may I call you here?
Sure.
Okay. Would you tell us something about your family history and your education?
Sure. My parents are fairly well educated. My mother, of course, finished high school at a time when not all the ladies finished high school, and then she went on to business school in Chicago, and met my father when he employed her as a secretary, and after a couple of years they got married. How about that for a modern thing? They were married in 1923, and this year they're having the 71st wedding anniversary.
That's wonderful.
Which they had just 2 months ago. And they live over in Lakewood Meridian. My father is 97, she is 92. My father's family were mostly teachers, as far back as we can find when they came here from Scotland. And my great-grandfather came on the boat from Scotland, arriving about a week before my grandfather, William Kirk Fowler, William Kirk Fowler Jr., was born in New Jersey. And William Kirk Fowler grew up in mostly around New York City. And he was educated at the State Normal College in New York then, and eventually wound up in Nebraska, where some of his brothers had come, around Great Bend, Nebraska. And grandfather was a teacher, and then he became a principal of a school. He had been at Tremont, a couple other places, and he wound up at Blair, Nebraska, where he was superintendent of school starting in about 1892. And in 1900, he had built the Blair system into such a good school system that it had kids coming to that school system from all over Nebraska. And guess what they brought willingly? They brought a voucher from their own school district, and they lived with people in Blair, and it was a large district, and while he was there, they built a big new high school, and he was rather famous for that, although he was never, he wasn't what you would say was a politician at all. But in 1900, he ran for the state superintendency and was elected, and then he was elected for 6 more terms every 2 years as the state superintendent of schools in Nebraska. And we have a lot of documentation on it. He was a very effective person, working with public education at a time when there are many other things that children were expected to do in Nebraska, other than going to school. And his writings about running the school and about his relationships with parents and everything else are very modern. That is, you could read them today and say, well, golly, many of those problems were the same problems we had. My father and his two sisters and brothers were all Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Nebraska. And so when he went to work for the Bernard Gepard Company, a map publisher in Chicago, he was pretty well prepared to do that, and he worked for that. It was about the only company he ever worked for. And he retired from there when he and my mother came to Colorado in 1952. But in the meanwhile, my twin brother Parker, and I had gone into the Navy in 1943 in the Navy College training program. And the Navy sent us to Bowles, believe it or not, to the ROTC program there. The Navy ROTC had started there in 1932. So by 1943, when the V-12 program started, CU was in really good shape to accept more students to enlarge the ROTC unit there, which they did, and that's why Parker and I came to Boulder. And I had already done 8 months in the Navy program at the University of Wisconsin in engineering. I was a graduate of Evanston Township High School, which competed annually with Mutual Township High School in Winnetka, Illinois, as the top high school in the country. So I was blessed with an absolutely elegant public education in one of the very best schools. And that led me to my interest in education when I was commissioned at Boulder, and then after the war, I went to South Pacific for years, and I came back from CU to Boulder in 1946, changed my major from engineering to business, and completed that 2 years later in 48, and went to work in Luke. And I've been in business ever since in Denver, one way or another, mostly in advertising, publishing, sales, and owned my own advertising agency for 20 years, and have done some other interesting things. I was recalled to the Navy Reserve in 1951, and did 3 more years of active duty in the Pacific and in training. I was turret officer, gunnery officer on a heavy cruiser, and spent a year shelling in Korea during that war. And incidentally being shot at, which has a lot to do. My first time overseas was not so bad because I wasn't married. I was 19 years old when I was commissioned, and so that was a lot. But when I was recalled and had a family started, I left Shirley there on the dock in North Island. She was pregnant and had chickenpox. And I happened to be the officer in charge of the fantail on this big cruiser waving goodbye. I was about the last guy to wave anybody goodbye, and that was a different order of things. And of course, being away from my family for a year was difficult. I didn't see my little girl until she was several months old. Anyway, my career in business was interesting, always interesting, and always drawing heavily on my own education. And I've always felt that it was just lucky that I had such a wonderful high school education, because it made college so much easier, and also made it possible to do other things in college that some other people might not have
had. A strong basic education.
Absolute fundamental education. And when I was a regent of the university in 1983, I was carried in my great impatience with the quality of education in Colorado, which I have questioned from the beginning, and one of the few things that I was able to do as a regent was to get the other regents to agree that our admission standards for the university would be roughly equivalent to the College Board standards at Evanston High School for years of English, and it was very difficult.
Math.
2 years of foreign language, 3 years of hard science, 3 years of soft science, 2 years of foreign language, a year of geography. And of course, the high schools here just really, they went berserk. They couldn't understand how the university could make it so difficult for kids to get in. Well, we gave them 5 years to do it, and I think that there was a surge in the quality there for a while, and I think it's they made enough changes. The winds have taken over, and they've let the barriers down, so that, but anyway, that was a very good thing that we did there. And so educationally, I have felt that I had a great advantage in going to good schools and having great teachers.
Hugh, what made you decide to run for office?
I'm always, uncertain how to answer that question. I was busy in politics as a layman, as a committeeman, as a person who had
block worker.
I have done everything from stamp licking, anything that you could imagine in politics. In 1958, we lost a very important election. It was like when I say we, I mean the Republican Party. In 1958, there was an amendment on the ballot to make Colorado a right-to-work state. And the unions spent more money in that election than had ever been spent before, by any self-interested group, but the unions are, of course. And they were very successful in killing Amendment 1, the right-to-work amendment. But in the process, of course, they wiped out most of the Republican candidates. So in Arapahoe County, where we live, we lost most of the contests. So at that time, I had become acquainted with Gene Toole, who owned a local advertising agency, and I was in the publishing business in Englewood. And so he was buying some of our publications for his clients. I got to know him through the Advertising Association, and we hit it off pretty well. And he asked me if I would like to be his associate county chairman. He was the county chairman for the Republicans then in Arapahoe. And this is one of the wisest things that any political party ever did under Dick, whatever his name was. They decided, and I think it was a national thing, not sure, they decided that every elected Republican official, not the people in office, but the people running the party, each one would reach out and find an associate who was less than 35 years old and do everything with that associate. And it worked great, especially with people like Trill, who took it very seriously. And he recruited me to be his assistant, and one of the things that I was supposed to do was to help him recruit other people. And within a year, we had most of our organization duplicated. So we had the old-time Republican committee man, committee woman. Okay, so we were very successful in rebuilding Arapahoe County. And for years, of course, it was the bastion of Republicans. Gene illustrated, and I wrote, a thing called the Precinct Committee Man's Manual. There hadn't been one before. And we used that extensively in our county, and then the state said, well, could we use it in other counties, and they reprinted it as the manual, and then it went up to the National Republican Committee. And I've seen similar things that uses artwork and my copy. So I know that made a contribution. Well, I was busy in the party training new people, and became secretary someplace along the line, and was secretary for many years. And in 1968, a couple of weeks before our senatorial assembly, Ed Scott, our senator, Chair Scotty, announced that he was going to run for re-election. And we had no candidate. And of course, that's one of the things that a party should do is train candidates, make sure you got people ready. We thought everyone was sure that Ed was going to stay in this and run for re-election. He was very popular. There wouldn't have been any question about his re-election. So we had no candidate, and a couple of funny things happened on the way to the polls, but I wound up with a primary. I was asked to run. I wasn't sure I wanted to. There was a group of parents. I'd been busy on school matters in the Littleton schools, trying to do something about any problems we had there. And these people said, well, you can get more done if you're in the legislature. So I said, okay, we'll do that. And at the last minute, another candidate surfaced. So we had a primary, and of course, when that person came out of the bushes, all these ladies that were helping me, and it's the women usually that win these elections for you if you're going to win, they really were very angry. Because I had asked this guy if he had wanted to run, and he said no. And so I said, well, I'll ask him. So anyway, we had that election. I won and was delivered to the State House.
Bring us to the elected.
Well, I think anybody's glad to win, but I was very happy to have this other guy run. I mean, I had asked him, two of us, right hand of him, several other people there.
Were you apprehensive when you were going to come down to serve?
I was concerned first about my business. I was really worried about how much time it would take. But in those days, you know, we were only 2 years past the time when they met every other year. And, you know, by the time the crocuses were pushing their little heads through the dirt, most of these guys around here were ready to go home. And when the hoops began to the calf, you know, and the calf started to fall. These guys were ready to come home, like the Cowboys. And they saw to it that 90 days was about it. And in that first year, of course, that's how. But I was concerned about the time. But I was very proud to be elected, and in all humility, I thought that I could do a good job. I learned that I was one of the few business people here. And one of the things I discovered, I think you asked me what was the thing that impressed me the most. I was dismayed by the condition of the Capitol. I stood there at the back of the session of the Senate. My first day, I was proud to be there. It was wonderful to be there with all these important men whose names were known to me, although many of them I didn't know personally. And I looked around, and it just occurred to me that this was a very dirty place. And my Navy training, of course, is that I don't like that.
Okay.
You know, you can't run a ship that way.
That's right.
And this place was one big butt kit. And they discarded cigarettes on the floor. They threw them down, men were still spitting on the floor. The spittoons were gone, but they had only been gone a couple of years from both houses. And these guys were still spitting on the rug, and the rug itself looked like something out of a Fox Theater that had been in there 40 years. And everything had this patina of dirt, and the brass was corroded, and the walls hadn't been painted since 1950. And I could remember, because that had something to do with that election in 58, the right to work thing, the union situation. You may remember when the painters, the Capitol crew decided to use roller to paint the building in 1950. And the union went crazy. They took the displays, shut down all the, they went on strike. Because the Capitol was going to be painted with roller. Well, they painted with rollers, but they painted it all the same color. And it was all gray, deep gray, navy deep gray. And I thought, oh boy, I've had enough of navy deep gray. Served on several ships, and you should be able to escape that. But a building is basically beautiful as this one. So I sat thinking about that, I think, on my first day. Of course, there were other things that occurred to me. But,
Mm-hmm. It was your ceremony, like that first day. I know the Chief Justice came in and tore the members in. Was there any pomp and circumstance? Was there?
No, that's another thing that bothered me about it. I really felt that there should be some. And later on, I improved that. You may remember that in the Senate anyway, and I think that it sort of leaped over to the House. But I felt that we should have music, we should have band, we should have a really good prayer by somebody who's going to do a good job of that. We should publish it. We should have a special calendar for that day. And Comfort Shaw was the Secretary of the Senate, and she was wonderful. She just agreed with all these things that I wanted to do. I think she had wanted to do some of them also. But many of the things were really difficult. The Senate was still set in the journal and calendar in hot type in those days. Hank Kimbrough had just changed the House over the year before into cold type, but the Senate was still using hot lead, and it was a terrible process. We had copy readers working here till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It was ridiculous. And that was one of my impressions also, because being in the publishing and advertising business, I knew that there were better ways to do these things. And as I became more familiar with what had to be done, I was able to make some suggestions. And working with Comfort, we finally brought the Senate into the 21st century, but it was hard.
I worked for Comfort that one year, and I've always appreciated everything she taught me. Mm-hmm. She was a wonderful lady.
Yeah.
Let's go to some of the issues. Can you tell me what was the first bill you introduced and what happened?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that, Lee, and I don't remember what it was. One of the first, I think the first bill I spoke on was one by who later became a Republican from Denver and ran for Congress. From Denver.
Oh,
golly, I'll think of it. Anyway, this was a bill. He came over and he said, you're Presbyterian, aren't you? And I said, yes. He says, I've got a bill here that's very important to the Presbyterians because we have a law that relates to the corporate nature of the religious organizations, and Presbyterians are organized in a slightly different way. So actually, the session of a church is acting illegally, and we need this law to fix that. And he said, I'm in the minority. It would be nice if you would help me with this. I'd like you to be the sponsor. And I think that was the first act. It was just a couple of sentences long. And they gave me a lot of junk, you know. It was my first bill. I remember that. But one of the first important bills that I really worked on was the Marriage Act, which set up the little train from Anamigo to Chamonix, New Mexico.
I wrote that during the summer, and I saw the news house that was halfway to Chama, and it was everybody's name on it, and Clarence was from that area. He was the representative from that area.
That's right.
Beautiful. It's wonderful that that was saved.
You mean the sublet? A little town of sublet along there? Yeah.
They have this wonderful new building there where the train stops and everybody has lunch.
Well, I think that's Fraser.
Oh,
that's
right.
Fraser. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a big new building for the lunch. Yeah, that is a nice building.
But I remember some of the data on the floor that I just felt it was wonderful that was saved. Otherwise, we would not have it. And I understand it's the highest narrow gauge railroad still running.
In the world.
In the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was important to me. Wayne Denny, the senator from Durango and Cortez, came over to me and said, you're interested in railroads? Yes. Said, I have this bill that I'm sponsoring with Quinlan in the House to do something about saving the mail gauge from Alamosa to Durango. And I'm very enthusiastic about this, but when I talked to the Chamber of Commerce people at home, they told me that they'll kill me if this thing gets passed, because that railroad would be competitive with the Durango service and the railroad, which was their big tourist attraction, has been for years. This navigation line hadn't run since 1957, so they were not at all crazy about having it running again. He said, I've got to find him a sponsor. Will you do it? And I said, of course, I'd be glad to. But I was having my own political problems in the Senate. I was a metropolitan senator, but not from Denver. I was from Littleton. The Senate at that time was very largely agricultural. And that meant that some of the things that I was doing, for instance, one of the first things that happened to me was I put on the Water Committee. And I was the only metropolitan senator on the Water Committee. And I'm on the committee with all these cowboys and farmers, neat guys. But they had a different view of water than I did. The law is very clear about water, and the metropolitan use takes priority over anything else. And the agricultural use, of course, is what they were trying to protect. So they were really worried about me. My amendment that I wrote, prepared, and got passed on the water bill, Senate Bill 59, and we codified all water, very, very important. I think we had 50 meetings of that committee.
One of the most important bills you can carry them.
And I went to all the meetings, and I learned early that there's an awful lot of wasted time there, sitting around these meetings with these guys, blabbing, talking about stuff, but half of it I didn't understand, the other half I didn't agree with. The amendment that I put on said that you can continue to recycle water if you can keep track of it. Now, up until that time, any recycling effort that Denver might make, you know, of running the water through the sewage plant and making it fit to drink again, which they do out there, and then bringing it back and using it for irrigation or anything else, that's what the Navy would call fire and flushing, okay? But that was illegal. They couldn't do that. So this amendment went on, and they suffered the amendment, but they didn't particularly like it because they didn't understand it, and they thought that Denver's sludge was going to be coming out of their faucets in Fort Morgan, you know, and that isn't. But anyway, that was important. There were several other important things, but the railroad deal, I got crosswise with Doug DeBerard because I brought my railroad hat down. And you know, I always tried to wear sort of an Ivy League costume. I think it's very important for people to be dressed up when they're in the Senate. And they've sort of gotten away from that these days, but all the senators used to look very nice. And it was a part of our mutual respect that we looked good. So she was worried that with my Ivy League clothing, I was also wearing this crazy engineer's cap, my Denny's cap. And during the debate, I brought in some slides that I had taken from the air of this whole line, and some slides of Alamos and some slides of the train and other stuff. And I brought a slide projector in and actually projected it up on the wall. I guess nobody had ever done that before in a Senate session. And I said, you know, I'm sorry if you think that I'm out of line on this, but I don't have enough votes yet. And I promised Clarence Clemon that I'd get this thing passed over here in the Senate. There were a lot of them that were just kind of, they were fooling around with me because I was a rookie. And I knew that. I thought eventually they would break down a vote. But for a while, we only had 10 or 12 votes, and we needed 18. And, you know, there were other things about that bill that were very difficult. It probably doesn't belong in this report, but it has to do with some other things that we'll talk about if we get to some of the stained glass windows, because the narrow gauge railroad was extremely important to Colorado. If it hadn't been for narrow gauge railroad, Colorado would probably be a suburb of Albuquerque. I don't know exactly what it would be, because the way the state was developed, the way it was left, the migration to the west went around Colorado. It either went over it on the Overland Route or went on the Santa Fe Trail. And we were left here. The railroad into Denver was an afterthought. The main lines went north. And so the narrow gauge was very important because it made it clear that you could have a good communications and transportation system in these difficult mountains. And the guys that built those were all heroes, and it was tremendous. So I thought, guys, you know, we've got to save some of this railroad here. For one thing, the San Luis Valley, and I've gotten to know something about the San Luis Valley because one of my interests was in cloud seeding. And working with the farmers down there, we showed them that by the correct kind of cloud seeding, we could help them to avoid these terrible hailstorms that they have there, but it used to wipe out their grain crops, especially their barley, their Coors barley. And that was one of the big crops in the San Luis Valley. The farmers down there over the years have really spoiled most of their agricultural land with their irrigation methods. The sheep business is virtually gone. Of course, Clarence Clemon was a big sheep man and a cattle guy too, but the cattle business itself is just almost gone. So I'm making this claim that this railroad, if it's a tourist attraction, is going to bring people to the San Luis Valley. Well, that was a big yawn. You know, many people don't know anything about the San Luis Valley or care. So I felt that I had to exert some of my advertising skills and really do a job on this. And we did get it passed, and it has been very successful. Today, it is essentially the largest source of revenue for the Southern San Luis Valley. If it went for that road, I don't know. I guess everybody down there would be on welfare. Today, it employs a lot of people.
And to me, it certainly has many people working on that railroad. It is beautiful, and I thank you.
Oh.
It would not have been on it this summer if you hadn't done this
road. Good.
You remember the first bill that you got passed through both houses, and that's the governor signed? Was that the railroad bill?
No, I think it was probably a Presbyterian bill.
But you cut
it. That had to be done rapidly. Arch Becker is the guy I'm thinking of.
Oh.
Senator Becker.
Southwest Denver.
Yeah.
I remember him.
Clarence W. Becker, but we all called him Arch. And he's the guy we asked him to do that.
You told us that one of the major issues you were involved in during your years down here was education. And do you think the public was aware of some of the problems in education? I mean, the, you know, the parents that were out there getting their kids ready to go to school, did they understand some of the problems that were going on? I know that Dave Hamill was one of the first members of the House that changed the funding of education.
That's right. And that was fairly late. That was 1956.
I believe so.
Or maybe it was later than that. Oh,
I think
it was 1964, I think, that happened.
So he came in 1938 and served 16 years then.
So that would have been
in the early 50s.
Yeah, 50s, well, I have the date right there. That particular funding scheme, of course, was a little different. It provided for a state contribution to the education of each child in school. Basically, that went back to, in 1900, the state contributed 5 cents each for the children in the public school.
Each school,
no? No, 5 cents a year, that was the because all educational expense was supposed to be local. And in those early years, there were hundreds of school districts. In fact, if you look at the original grant, from the federal government setting up Colorado, one square mile out of 36 was considered a school township and was to be used for school purposes. So if you look at an early map of Colorado, that shows schools with a regular pattern in there of these black spots. And in 1952, the Reorganization Act changed the state school district from about 1,500 to about 200. And it's gotten smaller. Most of the time, I've been in those places, there are 180 districts. But the number is going to be smaller. The Foundation Act, the first state Foundation Act, was actually in about 1970. Les Fowler did that. Les Fowler was from Boulder. He and I were elected the same year in 1968. And he brought in a great interest in education. He had been the Education Committee Chairman in the House for 2 terms, for 4 years. So he brought over a lot of experience in that. I brought with me a lot of experience working with the local school board in Littleton and in Englewood. And the answer to your question is, did the parents share my concern? Yes, a great many of them did. And it's interesting that in 1969, that spring, when I started in the Senate, we had a meeting. Over 500 people came to a meeting of the school board in Littleton, raising hell, just saying, this is 500 people. Yeah, it was in the big gym, of course, I think. And they were very angry, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, the meeting was finally over, and most of the people had said or heard what they wanted to hear, but there were about 100 people left who were interested in a proposal that I made, that we asked the Board of Education to set up what we call a fundamental school. And these people later appeared in, just a week later, over at the other school, and we split up into 10 committees, and I chaired the whole committee, and we went back to the school board and said, this is what we want to do. Will you help us do this? And they said, well, we're not sure. You have to bring us a plan. The administration said, we're too busy. We can't do this. You'll have to do all the work. And I said, well, we're willing to do it. We've got 100 people here. We will do the work. So 6 months later, we took them back a big plan, and it was a complete plan. It included what school would be the school they were abandoning, and who the principal would be, who the teachers would be, who would drive the buses, who would man the cafeteria, who would do the library, everything. What the curriculum would be, and we were proposing a different curriculum. We were proposing a back to basics 3-hour curriculum, and which they were abandoning then. See, that was a long time ago, but that's how far back you asked me. And people have been angry for longer than that. I was angry. My children, Larry was six in 1960, and when she was in first grade, and I followed her by 1964 in fourth and fifth grade. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I was reviewing her work, and in one of the best school districts in the state, right? And she was not learning. She was having a good time, but Chuck didn't do a whole lot better. Well, anyway, we took this thing, and the school board turned it down. So we almost had a civil war in Littleton. They had one two years ago, the election, remember, and completely threw out the school board. But it took that many years for this thing to fester and finally blow up the way it did there. So people were very, very worried. But you know, people turn their children over to the public schools thinking that this is a very responsible organization, and these are our treasures, these are our most priceless gifts, our children. And nobody would ever abuse them mentally or physically. Of course they wouldn't. Oh yeah, oh wrong. That's what's happened to a whole generation, maybe two generations of children in these schools. They are that bad. And of course our culture is suffering, and we see that all around us. Why are all these things happening? It's because we have become decivilized. Our civilization is failing. And it's because of the schools. It's because of public schools. And it is a deliberate thing. It isn't something that just happened. This was done deliberately, consciously, by people starting in 1905, 1910. John Brewer and his friends, some others, caused it to happen. So somebody has to get up there and say, enough, we're going to fix it. And I am now, today, involved in trying to do a charter school exactly the same as a fundamental school that we proposed in 1969, 25 years ago. And if with any luck, we're going to do it right down there in Kaiser School in Denver. That'll be nice. Okay.
Well, education is always an ongoing issue. Someone told me the other day that they went back and checked the journal. I think it was Strickland yesterday. Went back and checked the House and Senate journal of the issues of that time,
mm-hmm.
and they're almost identical to today.
Really?
Transportation, education, and the prison system,
ooh.
And we're still working with,
yeah.
with those issues. Hugh, will you tell me how the committees were handled when you first came here? I heard that we did not have committee staff until possibly in the late 60s, the committees were just handled, and notes were taken by the stenographers. Is that the way it was when you first came?
No, in my first year, that was the first year that they literally assigned a legislative council staff person.
To your committee?
To the committee. And of course, I didn't have a committee until 2 years. No, that's right, 1970, when I became chairman of education. And also chairman, and then I became chairman of Senate Services, and then I was vice chairman of a couple other committees, transportation, and that came much later. I've always been interested in transportation, railroads especially. And I was trying to get light rail done for a long time. And finally, we got a bill in pretty good shape, and I thought it was going to pass in my last year, 1979, and there was a little misunderstanding there. I won't incriminate anybody, but it was probably the worst deal that ever happened to me in the Senate, and convinced me that I should get the heck out, that I had served my purpose, and I could do it. If that bill had passed, it wouldn't have cost the taxpayers any money. The way we had it structured, it would have paid for itself through development rights and some other things. And today, you would be able to take the light rail, instead of this crazy, funny thing they got now, you would be able to take it from a area across town and then straight south to Highland Ranch. And that kind of a light rail, that is the way light rail should be. And the lesson of light rail learned throughout the world, people know that's the way it should be. You put light rail where people are, and they would use it. So anyway, transportation was interesting to me, but the committee was dominated by Jackson and Bruce Jackson and, oh dear, I should have had a list of my fellow senators. Normal from college.
College friends.
And Jackson, of course, was a trucker.
Love the joke.
Yeah, yeah. Jackson, they're both neat people. They're all nice guys. You know, you had differences of opinion with people on both sides of the aisle. But I felt that I pretty well got along with most of the people.
Color is very fortunate to have a high caliber of members that we have. And I think that in all my years down here, I've never heard of vote trading or, vote buying and all of that. I'm very proud of this legislature.
Well, there's a certain amount of influence that the members try to exert over each other, and some of the lobbyists are successful and probably getting more attention than they deserve. But I guess I had a reputation for being uncompromising, and in this game, you can't be that way. You really do have to be able to yield. And I just have trouble doing that. Probably.
But you always have to keep your word.
Absolutely. And if you start making too many trades and compromises, you can't keep your word to everybody.
Right.
So I took Abraham Lincoln's advice, and that was, as you say, nobody's smart enough to be a liar, a successful liar. But the one bill that I did make a lot of compromises on was the Smoking Act, which I introduced first in 1975. It didn't get very far. It got out of committee, but it was killed on the floor very quickly because the restaurant lobby went after it. And I hadn't been able to get the restaurant lobby to do much with it. And in the second year, 1976, the restaurant lobby came around because we sat down together and we worked out a deal. And the deal was very simple, and it just said that a restaurant would have to have a sign saying whether or not they permitted smoking, and if so, where the smoking section was. That's all it was required. And that was fine with me because I felt that if a restaurant had to put up that sign, at least they had to be thinking about it. And they didn't have to provide a smoking section, but if they didn't have a smoking section, then for a non-smoking section, then they had to put the sign up and say, we do not have it. That was a pretty good crack in the mirror there. And but people were still, and people in my own party hated this. There were some of them that, as a matter of fact, some of the people are still really not talking to me because of the smoking act. In 1977, we made a lot of other compromises with hospitals and some other people. And when it passed, finally, Don McManus, my dear friend, Donnie McManus from Adams County, came down to the lectern. And during the vote, and the senators were then entitled to have a minute when they were voting to explain their votes. And he came down and he said, Mr. President, some of your power has a reputation in this body for never yielding on anything. He doesn't give an inch. He won't compromise with his own mother. He says, and look at this Smoking Act. He's made 50 compromises on this bill just to get it through. And I object to this. If he's going to be consistent, we should turn this bill down. Help him be consistent. Join me in voting no. Well, it barely passed. But it was pretty funny. And dear Don, He finally quit smoking, but it still killed him. You know, he died several years ago, and smoking was right there.
And now we have a smoking law here in the capital.
Well, we have it all over the state.
Oh,
we have it all over the country. That was the first bill passed in America to control smoking in public places. It took 3 years, and it was worth it, and definitely. You had asked me which bill I thought was the most important. I think that's the one. Because it saved not only thousands of lives, but it's made life a lot better for millions of people. Smoking is an ugly, unnecessary habit, and people who do it, it isn't a reflection on them as people, but I don't think they realize how bad it is for the others. Well, the issue is well behind us. I think the culture has changed, and smoking the food today is something that...
Yeah, I think that's right. Do you think any changes in state government since you served? Do you think the changes are good or bad? They're mostly bad. We need less government, not more. And the state, in many ways, has... Colorado is still pretty much a western state, but it isn't as western as it was when I went for the Senate. We felt at that time, for one thing, I believe that you should go down to Denver, you should look over the bills that have been passed and make sure that they're still working okay. And if somebody's got a pretty good idea, maybe we could adopt a few bills, but not very many, maybe 25 or 30 bills a year, and then go home and live with them. You know, and let the governor run the place. And if he stumbles and falls, hey, he stumbles and falls. It isn't up to the legislature to run the state. They're legislators, they're policymakers. And they shouldn't be trying to be governors, although many of them, of course, over the years have wanted to be governors. But I feel that this tendency to, especially until the amendment passed to limit the session, that even that is too long. That amount of time, 120 days, is too long. It has discouraged the kinds of people that you'd like to have up here. It's discouraged them from running because it takes too long. Our first year, as I said before, we were in here about 90 days. And for one thing, we were only being paid for 180 days in the millennium, in the biennium. That is 180 days for 2 years. So these guys knew, well, if they stayed here much longer than 90 days this year, that second year, they wouldn't get paid for the whole time they were here.
They paid something like $10 a day. That was about the pay.
Something like that.
And I remember Connor Birch was at the mic arguing, if you give them more pay, we'll be here till July.
Yeah.
If you could change one thing back to the way it used to be, repeal a law or relocate an office.
I think the worst, the one worst thing that happened to change the way laws are made was the Sunshine Act. That prohibited the caucuses from having secret meetings. Those meetings were so important. We got more good ideas. And we control more bad ideas, which I think is maybe even more important. In a caucus, you can stand up and tell some guy that he is what he is and what his ideas are worth. But people are unwilling to do that in public. So a lot of the stuff that shouldn't be passed for the last 24, 25 years, it's gotten through this place because of the Sunshine Act. Which means that everybody's here, these microphones right here in this room with us. We didn't have microphones because this stuff wasn't recorded. And the idea that the people care about that is not true. That's false.
You could have spoken at the door when you had your caucuses.
Sure.
And he kept everybody out, and like you said, everybody could bash hits and walk out. And
that's right. And we bashed a lot. I remember getting back to the education thing and the school finance, because that was one of those issues where most of the senators didn't want anybody to know how dumb they were about school finance. How many senators do you think really understood school finance? We had people proposing bills who didn't know it. And I remember standing up at a blackboard, and incidentally, the reason we had chalkboards in these committee rooms and maps of Colorado is because I put them here. I bought the maps. I supplied the maps. We didn't have, can you imagine a legislative committee room of a state that doesn't have a state map in it?
Well, I was used to them. I didn't know you were responsible.
That's right.
It's in years.
It has the filer name on it right
That's
there.
Right.
And of course, that map is old now, and there's a lot of it, but it's still a really good looking map because it's a it shows the...
The geology of the...
Mm-hmm. The mountains and the reefs. It's called a color relief map. And Jefferson, you know, is the guy who they named the building out of DIA for Cap Jefferson. That was his company, but my dad published it, paid for the publishing of it, but Jefferson comes from Canada.
Is that right? And it's used all over the world.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
It's called the Jet Book.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. But anyway, I can remember...
Feet.
Yeah, right. I can remember being at the chalkboard, and that's one of the reasons. I couldn't work without a chalkboard. I mean, that was a part of my business and doing advertising work and explaining stuff to clients. You know, you've got to be able to put things down graphically. There wasn't a chalkboard in the whole building. So we put these up. And of course, I'm just quite snippet about that, but it was very important. But I can remember day after day, chalk in hand, trying to explain school finance to my pal in the Republican Congress and trying to get some votes. And in 1971, I proposed a really important change. If they had bought it, it would have really, I think, been great for Colorado. But I couldn't get them. I could not get them to overcome the resistance of the teacher union. And the union just—it was very difficult for me. I felt that I had chairman of the committee, and that's another thing. Now with that gavel amendment, you have to hear all the bills. And, you know, I ruined a couple of suits just carrying around these union education bills that I wouldn't hear. And I stuck them in my pocket, and that was the end of
them. Under gavel, every bill has to have a hearing
mm-hmm.
before the committee, and it must be advertised in the calendar or announced at the mic, it's time and short, or in the calendar. And it's a good thing we have a limit on the bills that can be introduced.
Yes, it is. That's a good thing.
And I was on the floor the night that, I believe that was a resolution introduced by Representative Pam Credo.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion at the mic was, it was unconstitutional, it never worked, and all these things. And now other states have copied it.
Mm-hmm.
We went from, I think, six bills, and then we went to... I think it was five or four, and I'm not sure now that I'm not working on how many we have. Is it five now? Because that one year we had 1,300 or almost 1,400 bills.
Right.
There wasn't any space in the fire came up for them. Well, what's your favorite place in the Capitol is? What memories do you associate with that spot?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. Now, over the years, when I got very familiar with the building because of my interest in refurbishing it, and I had, in my business, I've gotten to know an interior designer here by the name of Bob Caudill, and he was a very close friend of my business partner, John Moore. And as I was looking around at the building, I thought, well, we really do have to have a plan to do something about this. We've got to fix it. And so I asked Bob if he'd come over, and he did a quick look at it, and he said, well, it's going to cost this much to do a really good design, because we're going to have to do some research to find out what it looked like originally and to get an idea of what some of these color schemes and things were in the old days. And there are some other things that have been changed here that nobody knows anything about. So we got the money out of it. We ran the money for that out of our tenant services budget. That was called the Toilet Paper Committee, you may remember. Bruce Sackman was the chairman. And I was her vice chairman. And I forget the other member. The other member would have been a Democrat. I don't remember who that was. But whoever it was willing to go along with us on it. And Bob brought in this sketch arrangement thing, and I showed it to Betty Gilmore, who was the corresponding chairman in the House. And she said, gee, we ought to do this together. And she said, I think I can find some money over here. So we did. We got together on that, and we got an appropriation to fix up the the Senate chambers and the House chambers, and some but not all of our offices. And then the next question was whether we were going to be able to do the rest of the building. And that took some doing. The governor had vetoed my bill, which had a $500,000 appropriation in it, for doing everything. For $500,000, believe it or not, we could have replaced all the window frames, the wooden casements that were rotting. We could have done a complete fix on the electrical and mechanical system. And we could have rebuilt the dome. And we had some other things. The press didn't like it. One of the ideas was to glass in a part of the balcony in the Senate and the House so that the press would have all the electronic stuff they needed, but they could have, but they didn't have to be quiet in there, because that they would have their own quiet room and they wouldn't be bothering the legislature. That it would have meant that they couldn't be on the floor, because they hated that. But anyway, this whole thing failed when Governor Lamb vetoed it. He felt that because it set up a capital commission, and the legislature did dominate the commission, there wasn't any question about that. But we saw clearly that other things were going to happen. For instance, the Supreme Court was moving out. Their building was almost finished. They were going to move out. And there were some other changes that were happening, meaning that the legislature would have more to do with the building than they had before. And we felt that the governor had many other places to put stuff, because he has all these divisional offices all over the state and all over the city. He wouldn't have to have more room in this building. Well, anyway, he vetoed it, so we had to go back to the drawing board on that. And his administrator's guy, and I tried to think, real tall, nice-looking fellow, ex-admiral, the Department of Administration director for years.
Yeah.
Really nice guy. Really nice guy.
It'll come
through. Anyway, we sat down together and we figured stuff out. And by the time we got all the cribbing up there, all over the building, and the painters were painting, people were saying, why do all the paint pails say Department of Transportation on them? No, it wasn't. Department of Highway. But we didn't have a Department of Transportation then. And I would always say, don't ask, because it was being done in an extraordinary way, and really, like so many things in government, if you don't have the right people working on it, you're never going to get stuff done. But the way it turned out, it was beautiful, and I was really glad to have something to do with that. But I mentioned the Supreme Court. That they were going to move over to their new building, and they announced that they were going to take their chandelier with them out of the Supreme Court. And
that was a brouhaha.
Yeah, I told the press that they would have to take me with them. I was going to handcuff myself to the chandelier, and if they were going to take it over there, I would be taken with it. Well, it was good stuff in the press for a few days, and then Eddie Prendo, the Chief Justice, called me and he said, we really ought to be able to figure out something, don't you think? And I said, well, I'll tell you, I got a deal. You leave the chandelier and you can take Justice Steele's stained glass picture. Take that over there and put it in the building. He said, that's a deal. And then he called the press and he said, we're going to take a picture instead of the chandelier. And I really don't think he could have taken either one of them. So many things about, there's no real authority or building. That was the real problem then. And in a way it still is, although we now have a capital committee. But
we now have the capital advisory committee.
Yeah.
But you cannot change four things in the building. You cannot change the woodwork, the marble, the rose on it, or the brass. Unless you come to the committee and then go to capital development. This keeps anyone from sawing through anything or ripping up a floor. You can still paint.
Yeah.
You can still move your furniture around.
I wish I were on the committee, because I think I would have
on something. I know this ADA thing was difficult to deal with, but I think what's been done on that is really, really bad. Well, you know, leading up to that, I was sitting in the Senate this one day when the Ed Johnson window was installed and dedicated. And this is the window in the back of the Senate on the west side next to Otto Muir's. And the Johnson, his family were there, and it was a nice ceremony. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, there's only one window left that doesn't have a stained glass window in it, and we better claim it, or the Democrats are going to get it. So I wrote this letter, and I brought you a copy of this to Mr. Love after talking to some people. And I had gone around to some of my friends to see if they wanted to buy a stained glass window to commemorate John Love's governorship. And we collected 10,000 bucks. And then I wrote him that letter and said, I talked to enough guys, we have enough votes to get this done, if it's okay with you. And he said, oh, well, I guess it's okay with me. I don't know. It's okay, yeah, why not? Okay.
Wonderful.
So we went to work, and we had a difficulty getting a picture of it. And finally, his secretary, what was her name, Dorothy, and by now, of course, he was the chairman of Ideal Cement down here. And